First of all, at the Council of Constantinople, it is suggested that the great sees are equal in jurisdiction. This is confirmed by the edict of Theodosius, found on page 31. But Rome is given the, it's called first in honor, then we come to A on the outline here, under 1. The canons of Constantinople in 381 claim for Constantinople the title the New Rome, since the capital had been moved to the east by Constantine. At this point, then, that Damasus takes an alternative, makes an alternative claim, that is, refers to the See of Rome as the Apostolic See, as distinct from the claims of Constantinople. Damasus then reasserts that no canon passed anywhere in the church has any validity unless it is agreed to by the Bishop of Rome. Now, here you have a great problem from now on, because just as you had the division between the East and the West in the Church after the Council of Nicaea in connection with the Arian controversy, as we've already seen, so after the reign of Theodosius, you recall, the Roman Empire is ruled by at least two heads. One in the west at Milan, the successor there is Honorius, and then in the west at Milan, another head in the east in Constantinople, who happened to be a Claudius after the reign of Theodosius. Now, therefore, when the western bishop, when the Western Emperor, Gratian, for example, Gratian does is, it says he is no longer Pontifex Maximus in the Roman Empire. And he allows the Bishop of Rome to assume this title. So that these two things take place under Damasus: the claim to be the Apostolic See, the Apostolic See, and the claim to be Pontifex Maximus in the church. Now, of course, you know that Pontifex Maximus is a pagan title. The pontifices, these were the board of elders, the board of control for Roman religion. They were not priests. And the highest of these, the Pontifex Maximus, was the chairman of this governing board of all pagan religious life in the Roman Empire. Now, the Roman bishop takes this title, which clearly implies something about the relationship of the Roman bishop to the other bishops in the church. That Rome claims to be the Apostolic See, that she takes this title, the Bishop of Rome takes this title of Pontifex Maximus, most historians agree is clearly in reaction to the canon of Constantinople, which somehow makes Constantinople a real rival as the new Rome to the old Rome. And the Roman bishop is now asserting his authority, his firstness in rank in the life of the church. But perhaps, if that is all important, all these things under number one, under the reign of Damasus, what is perhaps even more important is that Damasus makes Rome the holy city, makes it into the holy city via his various projects for beautifying and, if we can speak of it that way, sanctifying this ancient city. Damasus builds cathedrals. He rebuilds the catacombs, makes the catacombs accessible to pilgrims, things of this sort. He beautifies the city, emphasizing not so much that it is the capital of the empire, but that it is the capital of the church, the holy city. In the poetry of the time, this is, of course, associated very closely with Augustine's City of God, although this is certainly not what Augustine was talking about. One of the most famous poets from this period, who is one of those pilgrims to Damasus's holy city, is Prudentius, Prudentius. Just as you have the great poets under Julius Caesar and Caesar Augustus, I think especially of Virgil, who lauded the new Rome, the principate as distinct from the republic. So you have the poets now, and among them, perhaps the most important is this Prudentius, who writes poetry about the beauties of the holy city and the wonders of a pilgrimage to the place where Peter ruled and where Peter was buried. Things of this sort. He glories in the, first of all, in the victory of Rome in the world, the Roman Empire, this great structure that God brought into existence in order that his son might be born in a peaceful world, ruled from Rome. So the victory of Rome over paganism, over the world, but then especially the victory of Christian Rome over, and thinking primarily of this city as the center of all of this, over paganism. It's a very important kind of, it's very important in the sense that it popularizes the kind of things that Damasus stood for. So that while Rome is no longer the capital of the empire, with Damasus, at least in the eyes of the Bishop of Rome, becomes the capital of the church. It's very important. Now, it's also very important, I think, as we will be seeing when we move down to Tiresias and Innocent, but the church as a whole does not know about all of this. This is in the mind of the Roman bishop and the Roman church. Ambrose, as close to Rome as Milan, betrays no interest in these things that are going on, the beautification of the city and so forth. As you know, Ambrose, as we saw last quarter, is engaged in other matters. But there's no evidence in his writing that he sees Rome now as number one throughout the whole church. Something like, you don't speak of the Roman bishop yet, he doesn't at least, as an ecumenical bishop, even though he is a Western bishop. No one says this in the East, of course. Here you have a very great Western bishop who does not even know of this. Now, the next important developments come during this period, during the time of Tiresias, 384 to 389. It becomes very difficult now. Certainly with Innocent and with Leo I, we get some obvious developments. Whether they are as early as Tiresias, this is perhaps debatable. But it is true that during from Tiresias, we have the earliest authentic papal decretal. And the language of this decretal is perhaps more important than the decretal itself. All of the great bishoprics in Christendom, Constantinople, Alexandria, Carthage, have such decretals. This is the earliest authentic papal decretal. Now, it's in Latin. This is important. That's what number four means, to compare it with the language of Victor. Victor already, at the end of the second century, wrote all formal papal documents in Latin rather than in Greek, as had been true. The Roman Church, as you know, was Greek up until that time. The language of the church was Greek. So it's like this gives Rome, it very, very clearly puts Rome in the lap of the West, the Latin West, rather than Greek, which up to that point had been the language of the church. Well, this is certainly true of these earliest authentic decretals, but more than this. In Victor already, but clearly by this time, in the decretals of Siricius, the tone of these decretals is one of, number one, one of authority. Victor could attempt to contradict local tradition on the basis of the authority of Rome, his authority as Bishop of Rome. This is very clearly the case in the decretals of Siricius. One of them reads, "We bear the burden of all who are heavy laden. Nay, rather, the blessed Apostle Peter bears them in us." Now, this will come through brilliantly in Leo. Already clear in Siricius. That's why I say I don't know how much emphasis to put on this. We don't know enough about this individual to say whether these are more than words. In all things, Peter protects and guides us. We are the heirs of his administration. Another one. No priest of the Lord is free to ignore the statutes, the canons of the Apostolic See. That is the bishop, the See of Rome. These venerable definitions. So it's the language itself that indicates the change in emphasis now, and that's number two, from being merely a representative of the apostolic tradition. You could even grant the representative of the apostolic tradition. Rome is the representative of what the apostles taught. I think this is very clear in irony. Rome is the example. You have a Catholic oneness. The teaching of the apostles as it is passed out to all of the great sees of Christendom, but the great example of this, the great representative of this apostolic teaching, is the Bishop of Rome. In Siricius, the language indicates a shift from this to Rome as the receptacle of the truth. Rome, you see, not so much merely the representative, but the receptacle of the truth, and more than this, the guardian of the truth among all of the other churches of Christendom. Now, if this is not already true at the time of Siricius, it is clearly true by the time of Leo. And I think we can suggest that it is already in the language of the decretal from this period. Now, the next step. Can you see that better in the back, or is that more blurred? That's better? This is what we have to do then. We have to turn that machine so we get the stick tight. The next important figure is Innocent, primarily, but there are a complex of bishops here: Innocent, Zosimus, Sextus, and then Celestine. I group them all together because for our purposes, you can spell out the detail here in your listing of the Roman popes that you have. For our purposes, however, I think we can group them all together from 400 or thereabouts down to 430 or thereabouts. This is where the bishops of Rome become involved very clearly in the problems related to that are being discussed, especially in the East. You remember the destiny of Chrysostom? It was Pope Innocent who encouraged the Roman Emperor Honorius to write his counterpart in the East, Arcadius, to release Chrysostom. That the Roman Emperor in Constantinople had no right to depose Chrysostom from his see without Rome's permission, or at least without Rome concurring in the decision. This ultimately leads to Chrysostom's martyrdom. As you recall, Arcadius feels that he must get rid of this individual or it will cause trouble with Rome. And so he has him, as you remember, walked to death. There Rome interferes in a way in the East. The Bishop of Constantinople doesn't appreciate this, needless to say, the successor of Chrysostom. Then the question of Pelagius. The Eastern bishops are not as concerned with condemning Pelagius as was the Bishop of Rome. And the question of whether Innocent's feeling that Pelagius should be condemned, as he was in the Western councils in Africa, that this could then become necessary for the Eastern council, was quite a question. Never really settled. It's interesting, however, to note that you could have the councils in one area of the church clearly condemning Pelagius, where councils in another area of the church do not condemn him, and then Innocent's successor reverses Innocent's decision, Zosimus, and gives Pelagius a clean bill of health. Now, this is one of the things that Dehlinger, back in the last part of the last century, the 19th century, dug up to demonstrate that the bishops of Rome were quite fallible. That here you have Zosimus, who was bishop of Rome for about 2 years, who actually sympathized with Pelagius. Whether he was a Pelagian or not depends on which histories you read and whether or not you feel that Zosimus really understood the implications of what Pelagius was teaching, because, as you know, he was pretty cagey in the way he spelled out what he said. Then, of course, also the Nestorian heresy arises at this time, or rather perhaps we should say the Nestorian problem at this point. He's first condemned in 434-31, but in any case, these are all questions that arise between East and West during these first three decades of the 5th century. On page 115 of Bettinson, I don't believe I have that noted here, but you might take that into your notes, put that into your notes. Forget about that for a moment. That comes with the next section here with Augustine. The important thing, however, well, as I said, to summarize, number one, again, it's in the language of Innocent and of Zosimus, and also in the respect that these Eastern bishops pay to the Roman bishops, that you have the importance of these transactions between the Bishop of Rome and the bishops of the East concerning Chrysostom, Pelagius, and Nestorius. But what is most important during this time, it seems to me at least, is the limits, that the limits of Roman authority, even in the West, are clearly spelled out. When the bishops of Africa reject the decision of the Roman bishop about Pelagius, Zosimus, the successor of Innocent, when he comes out for Pelagius, the bishops of Africa, under the leadership of Augustine, suggest that the bishop of Rome must reconsider, that they cannot follow him. But not only in this area of doctrine, but also in the, but most especially in the area of order, are the limitations of the Roman bishop clearly defined also for the West. Now, the material here for this is found in Bettinson on pages 113 to 15. What happened simply was that one of the bishops in Africa deposed a presbyter of his church, of his congregation. This presbyter then appeals directly to the Bishop of Rome for reinstatement. And Rome, always willing to, I mean, this is typical of the Roman bishops at this time, always willing to come to the aid of someone like this, insists that he be reinstated. Now, no council, no diocesan council had appealed. No African diocesan council had appealed to the Roman bishop for this kind of a decision. And therefore, the African bishops feel that it is within their rights to meet and to reject this, what they call, interference of the Roman bishop. This comes through very clearly in the synod at Carthage in 424, where you have the on page 114 and 15 of Bettinson, where this synod tells the Roman bishop, "With all respect, we earnestly entreat you for the future not to be ready to admit to a hearing persons that come from this region, nor be willing to receive into communion those that have been excommunicated by us. Your reverence will readily observe that this has been forbidden by the Nicene Canon," referring to Canon 5, which suggests that each diocese should take care of its own matters, and that the bishop from one diocese should not interfere in the business of another diocese. The language here is quite caustic. Let's see if I can find it here. "If any should desire you to send delegates, do not comply, lest we should seem to be introducing the murky pride of the world into the Church of Christ, which shows to them that desire to see God the light of simplicity and the radiance of humility." Well, you can read the whole thing. What the African bishops are telling the Roman bishop to do is simply to mind his own business, unless you are asked to judge in a matter. Don't come down without such authority. Now, we have seen this before, when the Bishop of Rome seemed to overextend himself, went beyond the limits of, I suppose, where everyone would have agreed implicitly that he had a right to go, when Irenaeus must tell Victor that he has no right to insist on one date for Easter back in the last part of the second century, One Tertullian rejects the decision of the Roman bishop Callistus, or Callistus, when Callistus insisted that because he was the successor of Peter, he could forgive a fornicator. Cyprian's rejection of Stephen's understanding of rebaptism. The irony is, Tertullian and Cyprian don't say that the bishop of Rome can't hold his opinion, but they clearly limit him in his ability to insist that everyone else hold his opinion. In other words, they reject the idea that the bishop of Rome alone is the receptacle of truth and the guardian of tradition, insisting especially, as you remember in Cyprian, that it is all the bishops of the church who have this kind of authority. Let's go on then to Leo, who is perhaps the most important of all of these, and who brings this phase of the development of primacy, the primacy of Rome in the church, to its focal point. Well, first of all, Leo the First was a theological leader in the church. Whereas bishops like Damasus and Siricius and Innocent and Zosimus may have been willing to spell out certain decisions in matters of doctrine, they were not men who were looked to especially for theological leadership. This Leo clearly displayed in his famous tome that he sends to the Council of Ephesus in 449, the famous robber council, and which is ultimately accepted, as you recall, by the Council of Chalcedon in 451, and becomes one of the bases, at least, for the Christological settlement at that point. When you speak of the bishop, when the Bishop of Rome is spoken of as an incisive theological leader in the church, what people are usually referring to is Leo. You don't have examples of this before Leo. You have quite a number of examples of this in the Middle Ages. As I said last time, what makes Leo's settlement so interesting is that it is non-philosophical and that it is biblical. We took that up last quarter already. But in any case, this is very important because it's the beginning of something now, you see, where Rome can very seriously make a claim now to being the receptacle of the apostolic tradition. This is very obvious, they can say, in Leo, who is able to bring the whole church in the East back to proper mooring on the question of Christology. Secondly, Rome under Leo breaks the alliance with Alexandria. That's a very interesting development. At Nicaea and at Constantinople and also at Ephesus in 431, Rome and Alexandria are always united in their theological stance. They are therefore able to carry the day, usually along with the bishops of Ephesus, the surrounding Ephesus. With Leo, this changes. You remember the bishop of Alexandria at this time was Dioscorus, who was attempting to defend Eutychianism. And this perhaps begins already before Leo, when the bishops of the West, at the time of Augustine, this is what we took up under 2 of D, under Innocent, when Rome claims to be able to interfere at will in matters of in matters involving only Africa without appeal, Rome appeals to the Nicene canons. And when the African bishops asked Rome, what canon are you referring to? They referred to a canon that is actually Sardican, the Sardican canon, rather than the Nicene canon. Evidently, in the Roman Church, Sardica, considered to be an ecumenical council, was simply bound together with the canons of Nicaea. It is agreed, then, that they should write to the Eastern bishops to find whether they also have this canon bound with those of Nicaea. And Cyril of Alexandria answers no. It is agreed, then, that they should write to the Eastern bishops to find whether they also have this canon bound with those of Nicaea. And Cyril of Alexandria answers no. The Sardican canon is not considered to be Nicene, nor is it ecumenical. And needless to say, Rome could not ally with such a position. This is a matter of order. Coupling that with the problem of Dioscorus, and you can see why new alliances come into existence. Leo breaks with Alexandria and allies now with Constantinople, so that at Constantinople, at Chalcedon in 451, it is the Roman position in alliance with the bishops of Constantinople, surrounding Constantinople, that carry the day against the bishops of the Bishop of Alexandria and his allies. So that axis, the Rome-Alexandrian axis, we might call it, is broken at this point. Now, thirdly, under Leo, you have the most obvious appeals to the authority of Peter, which still exists in Rome. Now, I have there not line, but indwelling. Leo does not appeal so much to the fact that he is a successor of Peter, but rather to the fact that Peter speaks when he speaks, that Peter dwells in the spirit of Peter, as it were, dwells. He's the vicar of Peter. It dwells within the pronouncements of the Bishop of Rome. Now, it's not that Leo denies the idea of the line, that he is what he is because he is a successor to Peter, but rather he emphasizes that what he says is important because Peter speaks when Leo speaks. Very interesting how the canons of Constantinople, or Chalcedon rather, bear this out, where they say, Peter has spoken, Leo has spoken, you see, meaning the Apostle Peter. Leo emphasizes this very much. The next step, as you see, part three of this presentation, is the course of supremacy. We will continue then at this point tomorrow.